Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker. On today's episode, we are looking back at a segment of episode 24, where we talked about FM 7-100.3, Chinese Threat Doctrine. Today we will hear how the People's Liberation Army, PLA, has evolved their doctrine and why the PLA has reorganized to build a joint force. We'll hear from the host, Major Rich Deagle, and guests, Mr. Brad Marvel, a senior military analyst with the TRADOC G2, and Colonel Retired Rich Creed, our director here at CAD. Of note, when we first published episode 24, the 2022 National Defense Strategy was yet to publish the People's Republic of China, or PRC, as the pacing challenge for the Department of Defense. Let's join the conversation where Major Deagle and guests are talking about how the PLA adopted their doctrine from best practices around the globe and also long-held Chinese thoughts on warfare.
One of the sort of key correlations, going back to your point, is China watching our success on live television of the Gulf War, and that's really kind of where they started this evolution. But then tying back in Mao Zedong and Sun Tzu and a lot of their classical Chinese sort of elements of warfare, just kind of, especially kind of right up front in that first, and like you said, the first chapter was really set the stage for the success of this
It's one of those things that I've loved learning about, is the PLA kind of going to school on all of the world's militaries, not just the U.S. And they've adopted best practices from all over the place, but they've also tried real hard to maintain that uniquely Chinese perspective on stuff. And they take a great deal of pride in the history of philosophy and the history of the PLA and what they've done in the past. And that's all reflected in their doctrine. So it's not, as much as they're influenced by the world's militaries and taking best practices, they also try very hard to maintain a grounding in their own culture and their own society and so on, that I think comes through in their doctrine.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to reading that Act of Defense, and I'm the least subject matter expert of the folks on the panel here on this view, but looking at it, their history since 1949, from someone who's focused on doctrine, you see some themes that run through that. They kind of belie some of our common wisdom or mythology based on our experiences fighting the Chinese army in Korea, right? So you talk about human waves, it's always human waves. And or what was the other one? We call human waves is the broad one, but you also talked about how many hordes are in a Chinese platoon. My father was in Korea in the late 50s, and that was always a joke in the U.S. Army. Doctrinally speaking, how many hordes are in a Chinese platoon? When in actuality, when you read any of the other non-China-specific histories of that war, you really realize that they were fighting the way that they had to fight based on the army that they had and the conditions of, you know, we had utter air and naval supremacy. And so they weren't using human waves so much as they were using the equivalent of World War I German swarm tactics, where you would fix and then work your way around flanks and you would operate at night, much the same way we talk about operating in periods of limited visibility when you're fighting a peer threat, right? You look for opportunities when the enemy's attacking to draw them in and then attack, counterattack the most vulnerable aspects of that advancing formations, which cost us whole battalion task forces in North Korea in 1950, right? That wasn't the behavior of a primitive military culture. That was the calculated tactics of a very advanced military culture that was fighting only 1 year after they won their own civil war, right? So that's something that kind of came to mind. And then this idea of their movement towards joint operations, right? They were army-centric for a long time because they had to be. And it was always about the defense of Chinese proper. Now, we'll argue about what constitutes China, right? And that's really the source of friction between China and their neighbors. But that idea of evolving towards being a joint force is extremely expensive. So you have to have an economy that can pay for ships, modern aircraft, missiles, and so forth. And so I think it's a kind of a natural evolution of fundamental thinking that's been around for a long time. It's just that now that they have the resources to pursue the kinds of outcomes that rich nations have been able to do for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, I love your point about the Chinese tactics in Korea. The reason I think it came to the West as human wave tactics is that's what it seemed like to the guys who were being attacked. Like, this is there's a whole lot of Chinese soldiers that show up out of nowhere. I can take that perspective. You know, that's probably exactly what it seemed like. But what was very sophisticated about that is how the Chinese soldiers were able to move obscene distances on foot, carrying their gear at night. And it, like, no other military on earth was able to do what the Chinese did. And so it seems like they're coming out of nowhere, but the operational level stuff that went into getting them to that position and developing the doctrine that supports that was a lot of smart people did a lot of thinking about that and came up with a useful solution, a solution that worked for them at the time. And that same sort of approach, they've adopted the same that same intellectual rigor with their modern doctrine, and they still refer to people's war as that's still the Bible in a lot of ways, and it's just evolved. They haven't ever repudiated the ideas of people's war. They've just let them evolve to account for modern systems and global distances and so on. So that's one of the things I think that I'd really try to emphasize for my audiences is this is not an unsophisticated opponent. They put just as much thought into this as we do and have come up with solutions that they think will work for them the same way we have. So, and they've demonstrated it in real world. Now, granted, it's been a long, long time since they've demonstrated it in a real environment, but the processes are still pretty much the same.
Well, and you watch the old movie with Gregory Peck, Pork Chop Hill, and you look at that movie, which is a pretty well-done movie, and you're seeing, the American defensive positions were all dug in, and they got over head cover and all that stuff, and a lot of people probably don't realize that the last time the U.S. Army fought an opponent that had significant field artillery capability that could bring massed fires down on your position in conventional fight was the Chinese Army in Korea, right? And so there's a history there, right, a sophistication there. And so how did they do that when they had no air power over top of them, right? That should drive you towards thinking that they were a formidable opponent and not anything else other than that. Because when you adjust it for modern conditions with much greater capabilities and the ability to contest you in the air with a modern air force and a modern integrated air defense systems, a modern large naval fleet, and then even more probably intimidating, or it should be, is a space force that can watch and observe. That should cause people to take them seriously for no other reason than that combination of factors.
Yeah, I think also one of the general global military trends that we recognize is it's the battlefield is real lethal now, much more so than has ever been. And it's harder and harder to hide and harder. It's easier to target things. And I think that's reflected in our doctrine that we have conceded. We no longer can just park out in the open and we have complete freedom of action in rear areas. And so on. We assume we're always under surveillance and everything is targetable and so on. And so maybe a little ironic, we could learn something from the Chinese approach with regard to operating under a constant umbrella of enemy surveillance and the specter of long-range air artillery attack and so on, that they have never abandoned that as a central principle. And the their the basic ideas of infiltration and movement and limited visibility conditions and so on. That's something I think we can take a look at. And
we need to take, I mean, if we don't take a look at that, we're making a huge mistake. One of the things I do when I talk to audiences about what's new in multi-domain operations and this focus on large-scale combat against peer threats, and China is absolutely would be considered a peer threat, every bit as much as a Russia ever was, should you have to fight them, of course. And we're not saying that we're going to be fighting anybody. We're just saying that, you know, you have to prepare for the worst-case scenarios. But the U.S. Army culturally has got to get out of the idea and start to understand that other folks can do to us what we have assumed we could do to others with impunity since the end of the Cold War. So anything that we can do to anybody else with the capabilities we bring to bear in a fight, a Russia or a China, but particularly China, can do the same things. And that drives you towards, or should drive you towards, a cultural shift about your approach to operations.
And definitely kind of looking at that, sir. So 2015 kind of considered the watershed year of the most recent emphasis on PLA modernization, specifically kind of looking at the ground force, going backwards from the way, or going back in time to the waves of Chinese attacks during Korea, did some significant personnel cuts specifically to the People's Liberation Army. So downsizing and restructuring of their forces to kind of make them a little bit more modular, scalable, and capable for what operations that they can see themselves conducting in the future. So similar to kind of when the U.S. Army adopted the modular construct with the implementation of brigade combat teams, Brad, can you highlight some of the key changes to the PLA-A4 structure that are included in you talked about in 7-100.3?
Yeah, the biggest change, I think, from a strategic or policy level perspective, the PLA for most of its history was enormous, not just numerically, but their role socially, culturally, economically in China, but in a way that, you know, the U.S. military has a huge role in American culture, but it was nothing compared to the PLA. It's the political army. It's a, you know, the armed wing of the Communist Party and so on. So the change going away from that, the revolutionary army, to a professional army was huge, and it took a long, long time, and it's still ongoing in a lot of ways. And the biggest muscle movement there was breaking up the big army, breaking up this huge entity that had massive political influence and was so deeply ingrained in the way China operated. They had to break that up, and in order to do so, it's still kind of ongoing. The party kind of had to go to war with the army in a lot of ways, and you see pretty regularly now generals getting dismissed, arrested,
corruption,
whatever, corruption. Yeah, it's an ongoing challenge, and that's been going on for quite a while. But really, the reason they had to do that, it was a fundamental reallocation of their national defense priorities, and that they had to make the army smaller in order to fund the massive naval buildup that has been going on for the last 15 years or so, and to modernize the Air Force and to build the strategic support force and so on. So we really changed from a giant army with an Air Force and Navy sort of loosely attached to it to an actual legitimate joint force with the same sorts of joint equities that we have, that they are different services. They have different representation in their system and so on.
The joint forces, like how they kind of transition to like the individual theater commands by some military regions, similar like correlation to our GCCs.
A theater command is functionally the same thing as a COCOM. So it's a joint headquarters, and they have their subordinate joint commanders from each service and so on. The change from just the army doing everything and telling the Air Force and Navy what it needed to happen, you can imagine how the comparison I like to use is a lot of this audience, I would imagine, has been through a BRAC kind of realignment deal, and how politically charged that is in America, and how fiercely people fight for their equities. And what China went through is 10 times worse than any BRAC cycle. And they seem to have come through with a modern understanding of a joint military. Then getting out of the tactical level, I think it's they looked at the world's militaries, and the U.S. in particular, and came up with the Combined Arms Brigade is in most respects pretty similar to the BCT. There's some differences in structure and so on, but the basic idea is pretty similar. They have taken what we envisioned a more modular force, I think, than what we ended up with when we first went to the BCT construct. The Chinese are going all in with the modular stuff. And they have a bunch of different names for this stuff, like synthetic formations is one example. But everything's a task force. Everything's task organized. Everything is built for a specific mission and so on. And they've taken this basic idea all the way from the theater down to the battalion level, and they are all in with it. They're building the C2 backbone to support it. They're building the sort of modularity into their doctrine and their systems that would support it and so on. So they're going deep with it, and deeper than we were comfortable going.
Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the Kurin Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Mr. Zarek Fry from 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on Amazon Music, Apple, Odyssey, Audible, Spotify, or YouTube. Also, go ahead and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.